Thank you, Chair. Chair and panel, over the past several years, the Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, has repeatedly said that the Church of England should focus, above all else, on the needs of victims and survivors, and should always be asking what survivors want. This final hearing gives you the opportunity to take him at his word and measure progress in the Church against that yardstick. What do survivors want? For the survivors we represent, what they want and what they should be entitled to is a church which does the following things. Firstly, ensures that allegations of sexual abuse are reported to the statutory authorities immediately, in other words, as soon as the church knows about them, and that where the church fails to do this, there are clear penalties for those involved. Secondly, because not all allegations, of course, will be dealt with within the criminal justice process, and some allegations will raise issues about conduct of church officers and therefore need to be considered by the church itself, that any investigation of complaints is done independently and without conflicts of interest. In other words, that we have a fully independent system for the handling of complaints. Thirdly, that safeguarding in the church is also subject to fully independent oversight and scrutiny so that the quality of safeguarding is constantly improved and that failings are rapidly addressed. Fourthly, that victims and survivors receive proper redress, recognising the severity and lifelong impact of abuse, and do not experience the redress process as re-abusive and compounding the original injury. And finally, that the church seeks constantly to reflect on the lessons from abuse scandals, to listen to and learn from survivors, and to embody those learnings in its response to abuse, its theology and its culture. These are the things that victims and survivors we represent want and need. So where are we on those objectives? Firstly, on the reporting of allegations to the statutory authorities, you may have seen the publicity earlier this year about the Gordon Dickinson case in Chester. This was a case where the bishop failed to report sexual abuse allegations to the police. In response to that scandal, Meg Nunn, the chair of the Church of England's National Safeguarding Panel, told us, and I quote, that the church has to stop thinking that it can deal with these things internally. She is absolutely right on that, of course, and her comments were perhaps an acknowledgement that a mentality of keeping abuse cases in-house still persists in parts of the church, and we've heard more on that from Ms. Scolding today. So the question then is, what is the church doing to eradicate that mentality and embed a culture of external reporting? You will remember that at the beginning of the Chichester hearing in March 2018, we supplied you with a critical analysis of Church of England safeguarding policy conducted by the Pressure Group Mandate Now. In summary, and as you may remember, Mandate Now described Church of England safeguarding policy documentation at that time as, and I quote, a thicket of inconsistent discretionary guidance, which carries with it the risk of confusion, mistake and non-compliance. They went on to say that the challenge to anyone tasked with delivering safeguarding in the Church of England is the sheer volume of its guidance. Clear and readily comprehensible procedures, insofar as they exist at all, are hidden like needles in a haystack. They maintain that the so-called guidance does little to establish who is actually responsible for doing what and when, and they express the concern that there was simply no clear directional requirement that allegations should be reported to the statutory authorities. The guidance repeatedly used the word should about external reporting when it needed to use the word must. That was the situation in March 2018. In that hearing, it was suggested by church witnesses that there might be changes to that rather woolly language. So where are we more than a year on? Having conducted an exercise of spot the difference over thousands of words, it seems to us that there may have been some very modest tinkering with the language. We're happy to be corrected if we're wrong. But the point, perhaps, is that it's very difficult to tell. The thicket of documents remains, and to the extent that the language has been adjusted, we can see no attempt by the church to clearly communicate any such changes to all who work in and operate within the church. And this point about communication is very important. In this inquiry, we are examining and talking about child safeguarding every day. It's at the centre of our minds. But for most people involved in the Anglican Church, it isn't at the centre of their minds at all. It's a peripheral subject at best. So any attempt to change hearts and minds in the church has to be led forcefully and vocally from the top, and has to be communicated with clarity and conviction, and has to be constantly reinforced and repeated. And survivors don't see that. More than a year after this issue was raised, the thicket of incomprehensible guidance is still with us, and we say that no real attempt has been made to communicate to the wider church the simple and overriding imperative that allegations need to go to the statutory authorities right away. Who in the church does this and what the penalties are for not doing it? In your report published in May 2019, you rightly emphasised the problems with due regard and the need to change the language in the canon, which lacks clarity. In its response to your report published recently, the church accepts that this needs to happen. But the fact is that the desperate need for this change was obvious in the hearings in 2018. The church is now saying that proposals for change will be put before Synod in mid-2020, another year away. So what survivors see here is a lack of urgency about change. They see the church, in their eyes, dragging its feet, maybe making a few tweaks to the language, and the change to canon law, which was so urgently needed, plodding through the church's bureaucratic governance structures, but with no real vigour or clarity or urgency behind the change. I then move on to the second issue, the investigation of complaints which fail to meet the standard for criminal prosecution or which raise issues about church conduct which require disciplinary action in the church. These allegations will inevitably include many non-recent cases. Survivors have repeatedly called for these complaints to be dealt with by an independent body with full powers to enforce disciplinary measures. So where are we on that? In 2018, the church indicated an intention to explore the setting up of some kind of ombudsman scheme. Progress on that seems very slow. But in any case, to be clear, an ombudsman was not what survivors asked for. An ombudsman system, as we understand it, requires survivors to exhaust all internal procedures first, which for many survivors is simply forcing them to re-engage with the institution where abuse occurred. Survivors desperately want and need a system which is fully independent. I also make this connected point. Whilst I act for victims and survivors, the reality, in fact, is that this dissatisfaction and lack of confidence in the church's internal investigation processes is actually expressed not just by victims and survivors, but also by those who believe themselves to have been wrongly accused. And if you look at websites where these issues are debated, like Thinking Anglicans, for example, you can see that almost nobody, whether complainants on the one hand or those accused on the other, express confidence in the integrity of church processes. Both camps feel that the church's response to allegations will be coloured and driven by one factor above all, a desire to protect the reputation of the church, and especially the reputation of bishops, the factor that you've highlighted in your various reports. Bishops are heavily involved in the clergy discipline measure. The purple circle are still in control. So the reality is that to restore confidence, investigation of complaints needs to be dealt with by an independent body and one with the power to enforce any disciplinary action. Progressive voices in the church recognise this, and you will remember that in the last hearing, Colin Perkins, the Chichester safeguarding advisor, specifically recommended that investigation of allegations be dealt with by an independent body. Yesterday, the Bishop of Burnley said something similar. The need for such a body is even more obvious now than it was a year ago, but as things stand, we're no closer to getting it. The third demand of survivors is that the operation of safeguarding in the church is also subject to genuinely independent oversight, as Ian Elliott, for example, argues. Again, the need for that ought to be beyond debate. We know that it was only survivor and media pressure that brought the Chichester scandals to light. We know that significant issues remain. To take one example, just the other week, a survey by a survivor group identified that a large number of parishes have failed to make safeguarding information visible on their websites. We know that the need for external oversight is already acknowledged to some degree by the Church of England because they commissioned the Sky reports. But we also know that the reality is that the Sky auditing process, and it's no criticism of Sky at all, but that their process happens on terms dictated by the church itself. The church dictates when auditing happens, how much resource gets put into it, how quickly it gets done. So that leaves survivors with a huge question, which is, what will there be to oversee the church after this inquiry has gone? At the moment, what the church allows in the form of the Sky audits can be taken away as soon as this inquiry finishes and the heat is off. And Chair, unless you establish a permanent mechanism of independent oversight and scrutiny, there is simply no guarantee that even what there is there is at the moment will exist in any form after your inquiry has finished. And that this is a real fear for survivors, that the church can simply run down the clock on this inquiry and that the pressure for change then falls away after the inquiry ceases to exist. On all of these issues, we urge you to consider the statement submitted by our client, A90. Unfortunately, for health reasons, he was unable to give oral evidence in this hearing, but his written evidence is well worth considering. As well as being a survivor of abuse, A90 works in a senior role in a public sector organisation where he has responsibility for continuous improvement. So his role is to make sure that organisational change is implemented, and his expertise on this has informed his thinking about the ways in which change needs to be brought about within the church. He makes two key points on this. He notes that at Synod in 2018, the church stated its ambition was to become a safe place for all. But as he says, in setting out an ambition like this, the church also needs to provide some mechanism to measure its success in achieving this ambition. A90 notes that the Synod document contains absolutely no measures of success. It lacks clarity over outcomes, it lacks clear timescales, and it says nothing about specific ownership of actions. It is a set of aspirations, but without any clarity as to what is going to be achieved, when it's going to be achieved by, and who precisely will have responsibility for achieving it. In other words, says A90, it lacks the things that any managed project in a business or in a large public sector organisation would need in order to be successful. In A90's view, the church simply lacks the project and programme management skills and governance arrangements necessary to ensure that grand ambitions are realised. Projects of this kind cannot be run by gentlemen amateurs. The sort of gentlemen amateurs who seem to have decided to store highly sensitive files in a palace in Bishopthorpe in York, known to be at serious risk of flooding. And then when the personnel file of Bishop Victor Whitsey, who is accused of multiple counts of child sex abuse, gets lost in a flood, they simply shrug their shoulders. And as A90 also says, another issue is how do you get a consistent approach to safeguarding across the country in the church? He says, if you walk into Marks and Spencer's in Plymouth, you expect to receive the same customer experience as if you walk into Marks and Spencer's in York. But he suggests that the current structure of the Church of England makes this impossible. 42 independent dioceses and too much power with each individual bishop. And that means there is no guarantee of a consistent approach. A90 goes on to talk about how, in his experience, organisations cannot be both gamekeeper and poacher. They need independent scrutiny. He explains how the particular area of the public sector where he works was in desperate need of change, but change only happened when an independent regulator, an enforcer with real teeth, was established. A90 also gives the example of health and safety. Companies only started to comply with health and safety when an independent enforcer in the form of the HSE came into existence with the power to levy large fines or imprisonment in the absence of compliance. This has proved to be the reality in a variety of sectors, and the Anglican Church, he says, is no different. We urge you to heed his analysis and recognise the need for a permanent independent body to oversee safeguarding in the church, as well as independent investigation of complaints, as I said earlier. The fourth demand of survivors is that they receive proper redress. We say that within the limitations of the current civil justice system, the picture here is mixed. On the one hand, we recognise that the policy adopted by Ecclesiastical Insurance Group of not pursuing limitation defences, except in rare circumstances, is a welcome and progressive change that other insurers would do well to follow. On the other hand, there remain a significant number of survivors who have experienced the redress process within the Church of England as aggressive, hostile and harmful, and significantly compounding the original injury. Unless and until the experiences of those survivors are properly addressed and remedied by both the Church and by Ecclesiastical Insurance, survivors will continue to mistrust the Church, especially given that the Church has a significant financial stake in the insurer's parent owner, as we heard earlier. Finally, what victims and survivors want to see is a deeper cultural change, a church which is engaged in a continual process of re-evaluating its culture, its theology and its values in the light of the appalling abuse which has now been exposed. I'm afraid survivors see too little evidence of this happening in the institutional church. There are certainly theologians who are now thinking critically about the way in which religion can be used or misused to promote and facilitate abuse. But there is little evidence of this thinking permeating the church at senior leadership level. In the Chichester hearings, we heard about the deeply problematic role of the concept of forgiveness in Christian abuse scandals, how notions of forgiveness could be misused to shield and protect abusers. In July 2018, a number of survivors attended the General Synod. Within the safeguarding session, we heard a speech from Archbishop Sentamu. After making a nod to the importance of safeguarding, he proceeded, without any sense of irony at all, to talk at length about the centrality of forgiveness in the Christian message, without even a hint of awareness or thought about the role that a distorted concept of forgiveness has played in clerical abuse scandals. The issue was simply not even on his radar. This attitude is a fundamental problem. It needs to be addressed within the church, but this will take many years, and this is another reason why we need to protect victims of church abuse by external mechanisms such as mandatory reporting and independent oversight. Chair and panel, these are the objectives of the survivors we represent, and I hope you can see the frustration of survivors about the pace of change and the fear, most of all, that progress will simply stall once this inquiry comes to an end. We hope that you will keep those thoughts in mind as you hear the evidence in this hearing. Thank you.